You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, October 1st, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, author of Affluence and Influence, Economic Inequality and Political Power in America, and Why Americans Hate Welfare, Professor Martin Gillens of Princeton University. Also on the program today, the Obamacare exchanges are open in most states, or at least all states, but fully in some states. Meanwhile, the government isn't. Republicans consummate their long dance of foreplay that has existed really almost for 24, 30 months in a government shutdown. 800,000 government workers furloughed, 1.3 more not getting paid for their work. The impacts, where we go from here on the program today. And a couple other stories, but this seems to be the big one. It happened last night, as anticipated. The House attempted a couple of times to first fully defund Obamacare for the 45th time, I think it was, or 44th. Then it went to the Senate. The Senate sent it back with a clean continuing resolution, budget resolution. Because as you know, 5 or 6 months ago, the Senate and the House passed budgets, but the House refused to send members of the House to a conference to reconcile the budgets. So we only have continuing resolutions. And then the House tried to delay Obamacare for, 6 weeks of a continuing resolution. I'm not quite sure. Same thing resulted. And then at about 11:59, the House said, hey, we should send conferees to a budget conference. What? How did we think about that? 6 months earlier, of course, it was a little bit late. The government is shut down. Tea Partiers are very excited about this. And it's all because, of course, of this idea of expanding healthcare to literally millions of Americans. Exchanges are now open. About 1 million people have hit already the website. I've heard different reports as to that some of this could be right wingers trying to shut it down. But the idea of a website crashing because it gets too many hits, of course, is completely foreign. It never happens. It only has ever happened to the Affordable Care Act website. That, I imagine, will be the lead today on Fox News. So we will get to that. But before we do, we will talk to Professor of Politics Martin Gillens, whose study that was written up in his book, Affluence and Influence, Economic Inequality and Political Power in America, could very well be the single most cited study on this program over the past 2.5 years. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, Professor Martin Gillens. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program author of Why Americans Hate Welfare and Affluence and Influence, Economic Inequality and Political Power in America, Professor Martin Gillens of Princeton. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
So now I got to start by saying that I think that your research over the past 2.5 years has been the single most reference research on this program. And in just about every book that I have read on income inequality and its relevance to what we're dealing with in our politics. So I'm very excited to have you on the program. Thanks again for joining us.
Well, terrific. I'm glad to hear that. I think it's an incredibly important topic. So glad it's getting attention.
Now, with that said, before we get to that, and also your book, Why Americans Hate Welfare, which I think is as relevant today as it was when you wrote it over a decade ago, your thoughts on the government shutdown? Apparently, it's making a lot of news today.
Yeah, it certainly is. Well, boy, it sure underlines the dysfunctional nature of our system and the power of the polarized political conditions to wreak havoc on our politics. You know, we have a government that's well designed, perhaps, for situations where there's a reasonable amount of agreement, but not well designed for situations where small minorities can put up roadblocks, and we're seeing the consequences of that.
You know, I want to circle back on the dynamic that's taking place now, because In some ways, it at the very least, it is, I guess, in some ways, it doesn't necessarily fit. If the conventional wisdom is right about the dynamic in the House, it doesn't necessarily fit with your research. And you know, there may be a myriad of reasons for that, but we'll circle back to that. I want to start with affluence and influence. Your research basically describes the dynamic of moving from a plutonomy to a plutocracy. I mean, is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it.
Just tell us about what you found as you started to research how policy in this country reflects the preferences of the public versus specific subsets of the public.
Well, I was mostly focusing on affluence and how people with more resources have more political influence. Now, I, of course, expected going in to find that people with higher incomes and greater wealth would have more say over government policy, but I didn't expect the almost complete lack of influence of not only poor Americans, but of the middle class. And I think that's the most striking and troubling result of the analysis that I did, looking at the preferences of the public and the nature of government policymaking between the 1960s and the early 2000s. And we just find that under most circumstances, what the middle class or the poor prefer bears no relationship to what the government does, and it's only when they agree with affluent Americans that they see the policies they prefer being adopted.
How did you go about determining this?
Well, I collected survey data where people were asked about whether they would favor or oppose some specific change in federal government policy. And I looked at surveys across the wide range of policy domains, from economic policy to sort of social policies, foreign military engagements, raising the minimum wage, tax policy, everything I could get my hands on from the mid-1960s and then from the 80s and 90s and early 2000s. And for each of those policies, and there were a couple thousand of them, each of those policies, I had data on what poor people, middle-class Americans, and the affluent preferred. And I had a team of research assistants over a period of years then helped me figure out which of those policies were adopted. And what I found was that the likelihood of a policy being adopted was strongly related to what people at the top of the income distribution said they wanted. And once those preferences were taken into account, bore no relationship, except under unusual circumstances, to what middle-class or low-income Americans preferred.
Can you give us a sense of what, at least broadly speaking, what those preferences were? I mean, I presume they cut across a bunch of different issues, but, I mean, is there a way to sort of in some way summarize the nature of the preferences?
In a nutshell, I'd say the most consistent preferences are, first, what you would expect, which is that economic policies that are more beneficial to low-income Americans have stronger support among the poor. And those policies that are more beneficial to the affluent, such as, say, the Bush tax cuts or the elimination of the inheritance tax, you know, get more support among the affluent. So those kinds of economically redistributive policies. Second area is government regulation. Affluent Americans are just much less enthusiastic about government regulation of industry than is the middle class or the poor. And finally, on social policies, we have a sort of opposite political dynamic, where affluent Americans tend to be more liberal on things like abortion policy, gay rights, stem cell research, these sorts of things. But in all of these cases, whether the policies align more with the Democratic Party's traditional commitments of a progressive economic agenda or the Republican Party's traditional commitments of a less progressive economic agenda, whatever it is, I found the pattern to be the same, which is to say the preferences of the affluent are more likely to be found in government policies than those of other Americans.
How over time, I mean, you examine this over the course of a 40-year period or so, was it consistent throughout, or was there some difference? Is this a dynamic that is becoming more pronounced?
I found two kinds of changes. One was a sort of gradual increase across that time period in the apparent influence of affluent Americans over federal government policy. But the other change that I saw was not consistent and fluctuated depending on political conditions. And those were the conditions that I've alluded to, where there are some exceptions where the middle class and even the poor have greater influence than in other conditions. I should be clear, under no conditions does the middle class have as much influence over policymaking as the affluent, nor does the poor have as much influence as the middle class. But there are variations in how unequal that influence is. And in particular, when there is a presidential election looming, or when control of government is closely divided and it's sort of uncertain who will control Congress going forward, those are the conditions when the responsiveness to the public is broader and there's relatively more ability of a sort of broader swath of Americans to shape policy outcomes.
Essentially, when they need votes.
Exactly.
And that explains why we hear a lot more sort of populist economic rhetoric in the run-up to an election, and then all of a sudden it just sort of melts away.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right, and that's certainly true in 2012. And to some degree, it's reflected in policy. Although I will say a very interesting finding from not my research but others is that those policies that are adopted in the run-up to an election tend to have less staying power than policies adopted at other times. So there is a greater responsiveness to public preferences, but it's less enduring.
Interesting. And how does that, I mean, the social issues, I think it's, we're at a very interesting time, I think, in terms of the way that the worm has turned on the sort of this, on the more, social issues, the ones that have been more associated with progressives, because in many respects, a lot of these battles seem to, be coming, at least in terms of policy, to a close. I mean, maybe it's a little premature to say that, but a lot of things seem to be being taken off the table in some respects. And I wonder if the if there's anything that you've observed in the way that Democrats in particular have used these social issues. I mean, both, I guess, both parties have used these social issues to their benefit. But it occurs to me that when we look at, like, the Clinton administration, and even to a certain extent, the Obama administration, the use of social issues to sort of hide as a consolation for the economic policies that they, at least in the run-up to elections, tout. We seem to have almost come to a place where a lot of that has consummated. Does that make any sense?
That could well be the case. I mean, it's certainly true that both parties are trying to sort of cobble together coalitions of voters, and by combining, you know, positions, in the case of the Democratic Party, positions on economic issues that are more appealing to the middle class, but positions on social issues that are more appealing to the affluent. And of course, for the Republican Party, it's the reverse. And so, yes, the balance of the attention to these different kinds of issues will change depending on circumstances and, you know, which elements of a coalition the parties are most in need of support from.
And so what is, I mean, I the obvious solution to this dynamic is to sort of diminish, I guess, the influence of money in politics. But is it that simple, or, I mean, and is that one of your prescriptions?
It is, although the truth is we don't really know a lot about how different kinds of campaign finance policies and so on can affect those dynamics. So there's been a history both in the states and at the federal level of campaign finance reforms that have proven ineffective because both the incumbent politicians, the parties, and the people who want to influence policy are very clever at finding ways around these restrictions. And so I think there's been a number of proposals that have been put forth but never adopted for stricter versions of campaign finance and ways to really kind of squeeze the money out of politics. We don't seem to be moving in that direction. In fact, quite the opposite, at least at the federal level. But you're quite right. I think that's the most important. In some sense, it's the issue against which all other political issues will hinge.
And we should say that your research was done prior to Citizens United. It is obviously prior to, we don't know how this McCutcheon case, which is going to basically could remove limitations, aggregate limitations on giving. But is this dynamic simply a function of how much money is spent on elections, or is it also something to do with the classes that are represented in office and in our media?
Well, I mean, you're quite right. It's not simply the amount of money, but the sources of that money. And it comes overwhelmingly from, of course, the most affluent Americans and increasingly with things like Citizens United, that money will be more and more concentrated in the hands of fewer and fewer individuals. So the source of money is the critical factor here. I think we need policies that can help us to reverse course and bring in larger numbers of smaller donors, less affluent individuals into the political process. The truth is that there are some factors. I mean, the internet's probably the most important one that make raising money from many, many small donors more feasible. And we have seen some movement in that direction, so I think there's some reason for hope, but at the same time, the ability and willingness of these plutocrats to use their resources to buy the political policies that benefit them has also increased, and that's it's not going to be an easy thing to push back against.
How much awareness do those people whose political views are underrepresented in policy outcomes, how much awareness is there of this dynamic? I mean, obviously
there's actually a lot. I mean, I've looked at surveys that ask people things like, does government listen to the views of people like me? And it's quite striking that the more income people have, the more likely they are to say that government listens to people like them. So it's clear that the public is aware that money talks in politics, and that if you're not one of these rich donors, then you're standing by the sidelines.
But I mean, is there an awareness that it's a function of their class? In other words, I can be a titan of industry and say, I find the government to be very responsive, and not necessarily make that connection between, and it's because I come from a class of people who influence government policy more.
Yeah, I mean, that is true, and I'm sure there are people who sort of attribute it to other factors. For example, there's an argument that, well, middle-class Americans or poor people don't really vote that much, and maybe they don't really care that much about politics, and so maybe that's the reason why their views aren't being reflected in government policy. But I've looked at that, other scholars have looked at that, and that just doesn't bear out. And it's also true that people are quite cynical about government and about who government responds to. And we've seen that cynicism increase over the past few decades as well.
And certainly, in terms of the voting rates, I mean, we're seeing, I think, the low-income people voting at rates that are, at least in the past several decades, at extremely high rates.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly been no big drop-off in voter turnout and no sort of shift away from the involvement of the poor or the middle class, for that matter.
Do you think there's been, what is curious to me is if there is this awareness that government is functioning more and more at the behest of the wealthy, and at a time when we're talking about enormous income inequality, a limited group of people. I mean, are we seeing, aside from a certain amount of cynicism or an awareness when you're asked a question as to whether or not your views are represented, I mean, is it surprising to you that we're not seeing more sort of, and maybe we're seeing it from our perspective, but I sit in a fairly sort of myopic perch here. Are we seeing as much class consciousness and organizing as you would imagine in this instance?
Well, I mean, I would like to see more, but it's not a strong tradition in America, and unions have declined considerably, private sector unions in particular, over the past 50 years, and so we don't have as much sort of organizational capacity. Is it surprising? On the one hand, I'd say, yeah, it is, because clearly so many Americans are suffering, and we've seen how government responds to the needs of, the financial elite and so on over the last few years. And, you know, I think there is a cynicism, but maybe there's also a sense of, and it goes along with the cynicism, that there's not really much that can be done. And so, you know, people just go about their lives and hope for the best.
Let's turn to your earlier book, Why Americans Hate Welfare, Race, Media, and the Politics of Anti-Poverty Policy, because in some ways, I think the sort of the dynamic that you found in that research continues, well, I mean, it obviously continues to play out today, but I think in some respects it plays out in specifically what we're seeing in terms of this government shutdown. Just talk to us about what you found. Why do Americans hate welfare?
Well, when I started that work, I had assumed that two of the big reasons would be that they don't want to pay for it, on the one hand, and that they don't really believe that that's government's role, this sort of rugged individualism. And neither of those things turned out to be true. It turns out that based on how Americans respond to surveys and other kinds of evidence, that in fact people do think government has an important role in helping the disadvantaged and in getting, you know, getting people sort of back on their feet, and that middle-class Americans are willing to pay taxes to support anti-poverty programs. So why do they hate welfare if it's not those things? Well, it turns out that they think most people currently on welfare, and this is remains true going back many decades, but most people who are receiving welfare don't really need it. So there's a cynicism about how genuine the needs are, and that cynicism is driven in large measure by racial stereotypes, by misperceptions of the sort of extent to which African Americans compose the welfare rolls, and to the stereotype of blacks as less committed to the work ethic than other Americans.
And so we see at one point in the history of welfare programs, basically a significant number of Americans saying, I have no problem with welfare, I just don't want all these black people getting it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they say that, and they might not even think it consciously, for at least some. But nevertheless, it's very clear that the greater the misperception about the extent to which welfare recipients are black, the greater opposition to welfare among white Americans.
I mean, we see this, I mean, even today, I mean, you know, you did this book 10 years ago or so, but, you know, 5 minutes of listening to Rush Limbaugh, you hear about President Obama's slush fund and about, you know, the lazy people that Obama has just been elected by because they want to get free money from him. I mean, this is a dynamic that's still in play, and in many respects, this is what we're seeing with the government shutdown, aren't we?
Maybe so. I mean, it's a little bit hard to know. Of course, the ostensible focus has been on the health care laws, you know, my own view is that, you know, public opposition to those laws is probably not particularly race-based, although I don't really have strong evidence on that. But I think, you know, the Republicans and the right in general have done a good job of sort of muddying the waters about what the nature of the health care laws are, as they did in the 90s when the Clinton health care reforms failed.
But, I mean, if you're shutting down the government, and we're seeing all sorts of these Tea Party Republicans talking about there's no problem in shutting down the government. There's no problem. And then, you know, let's go backwards, too. There's no problem with the sequester. And we've seen this dynamic, you know, play out over the past 7 months, which, you know, the idea being that any of those people are being helped, whether they are children on and pregnant mothers on nutrition assistance, whether it's people receiving food stamps, whether it's things like Head Start. It seems to me that there's this sense that this is just all waste from their perspective. It's just this is all stuff we don't need to deal with. And in fact, our society is largely ignoring the devastation that's being wrought in different communities around the country because of things like the sequester. We're going to see this also when it comes to the government shutdown. And yet it gets very little attention, and particularly from the right a tremendous amount of scorn.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right, and I do think it's a sort of broader cynicism and belief that the government wastes a lot of our money, sort of a lack of awareness in some cases about what the government actually does do, what the money is spent on. But in any case, the sense that, well, you know, we can do without government for a while, and it may take actual, you know, programs that affect people's lives in very direct ways for people to, you know, really start screaming about it.
Did what we've seen with the sequester and the cuts that essentially were, originally contemplated to hit across society because this was going to be, simply a percentage off the top of all government operations, which over the course of the first month or two of the sequester, anything that really impacted wealthy people was immediately fixed. Mm-hmm. And anything that impacted poor people was considered to be really not so bad. I mean, this seems to play into this dynamic of the policy preferences of different classes of people, and it also we don't just see it in terms of the policy, and it's hard to say which comes first, the chicken or the egg, but also in the context of the way the media reported on it.
Yeah, no, I agree completely, and I do think the media are kind of culpable here, and really trying to bring to the public's attention what the meaning and the consequences of these policies like the sequester are. And I blame that partly on the Democrats as well, that, for the sorts of reasons we've been discussing, the role of money in politics, that, they haven't made the kind of statements to the public, the kind of appeals that they ought to. In terms of the way that these kinds of cutbacks, government shutdown, and so on, affects people's lives.
In fact, we're looking at the clean continuing resolution that the Democrats are seeking at this point is far closer to the Paul Ryan budget than it is even to the Senate or the President's budget.
Yeah, it's a sad commentary.
It is indeed. All right. Well, I appreciate your time today, Professor. And give me a sense of what do you think happens now in terms of the shutdown and the debt ceiling? I mean, do you have any sense of where this goes in terms of politics? And I guess let me ask you this. I'm sorry to meander here a little bit, but the how much does this shutdown, when we see that, you know, even the Chamber of Commerce is supposedly upset about this, it seems to me that the policy preference here of the wealthy would be to not have the government shut down, to not have the debt ceiling basically being used in this the manner that we're seeing the Republicans use. How do you reconcile that dynamic with your research? I mean, seeing a change here in terms of who's running the Republican Party and thereby the rest of our government in some respects?
It's two things. One is that it's not the majority of the Republican Party. It's a relatively small number of extremists, but it's enough of them given the nature of the way that the House is run. And Boehner's concern with his position as Speaker to exert an oversized influence on government policy. Now, how long can that go on with this relatively small minority and as you point out, against the preferences and the interests of, much of the business sector as well? And my guess is that it won't go on for very long. Whether there'll be a face-saving compromise from the Democrats in the White House or whether the Republicans will, simply steamroll their extremist wing remains to be seen. But I agree. I think the consequences are too great, and the influence of people who would suffer those consequences, especially the business community, are such that we will see a resolution and we will not see a weeks-long government shutdown.
But I mean, how do you reconcile the idea that stipulated that we're talking about a minority within the Republicans? Although I'm not so convinced, because the reality is that Boehner's making a choice here, you know, and he may be. He may be making a choice that saves his speakership for a while, but there's other choices he could make, and it's certainly the wealthy are not necessarily concerned with him being the speaker as opposed to anybody else if he can't do their bidding. We have one minority that has oversized influence versus another minority that has oversized influence, and there's a different minority that's winning this time around. Is this a trend? Because we have the minority that we're talking about being the sort of the base of the Republican Party in some respects seems to be fairly well entrenched in a way that even in 95, 96, they weren't. There's only, I think, 17 House seats where President Obama won and is represented by a Republican. So it seems that they are at least electorally entrenched, and their constituents don't seem to have a problem with what they're doing.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you're right. I think there's a small group, and I think they're pursuing their own individual interests, not the interests of their party, and certainly not the interests of the country. We'll have to see. I mean, it does seem like it's the new normal, but I hope that'll turn out not to be the case.
All right. Well, Professor Martin Gillins, thank you so much. We have links up to both your books, Why Americans Hate Welfare and Affluence and Influence. Thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Nice talking with you.
All right, folks. We got a little bit of time here. Do we have those audio clips pulled? All right. Just to give you a sense of where we have come in the past 18 months, 2 years or so, much of this started because of back in 2011 when President Obama negotiated over the debt ceiling and over the continuing resolution and develop this notion of the sequester. I mean, I got really annoyed today because there were other progressive commentators. I remember back in the day, not going to use any names, radio people who were saying this sequester is brilliant. It is a brilliant move by the president. Now, those same people would say that the White House didn't develop it, but they did. They did develop the sequester as a way, because they were under the misapprehension of who the Republicans are and were, and assumed that this would force them to the table so that they could get the grand bargain that they wanted. And we saw this desire for a grand bargain by the president as late as the beginning of this year, when he offered, I guess it was in April, when he offered a budget that included cuts to Social Security. And the sequester was supposed to have fixed this. It was supposed to have forced all the parties to the table. We are now looking at the Democrats. Their position is, we want a budget that still includes the sequester. The Republicans now are able to stake out a position. Well, we want a budget that continues to punish poor people, that continues to punish the middle class, that denies millions of people health care, that cuts more funding for the EPA, the FDA, the government regulatory agencies, on and on and on. The so-called Overton window, again, has been shifted to the right. And we were told this was the president's brilliant negotiating strategy and whatnot. And that the Republicans, I mean, how many times did we hear President Obama himself say? Well, in 2010, we heard it. In 2012, we heard it. The fever will break. The fever will break. We continue to hear this. And in fact, you know, we heard it from Professor Gillens. I imagine that the sane Republicans, the ones who just want to quietly defund things like food stamps and support for poor people, they will prevail over the people who just want to burn the whole thing down. Yes, they're going to gradually make people miserable as opposed to try and do it in one fell swoop. When we come back in the better half, we're going to play a series of clips from Speaker Bonaire over the past 18 months, which sort of outline his changing position. We will go through the 800,000 people who have been furloughed. The 1.3 million federal government workers who will not be receiving pay. The cutbacks on mine safety that have taken place starting today. The cutbacks on protecting our air. The cutbacks in protecting our food. Never mind things like research. We're not going to make the NASA launch to Mars or, I guess, in that area. It goes on and on and on. Workers are no longer being protected right now. Small business are not having their loans processed. On and on and on. And then we hear stupid, literally stupid pieces in places like Reason. It's President Obama's fault. He's the decider.
If you want to go into that, that might be the most stupid column ever written.
I honestly tried.
It's
shockingly
stupid. There's like, it's so stupid. How do you even pivot off of it?
It's almost impossible. Let us be clear. Obama deserves chief responsibility for government shutdown, writes Nick Gillespie, the free market Fonzie. And he completely sort of glosses over the notion of why there was no budget conference, why the House never sent conferees to hash out a budget that was passed. Remember.
Variety of reasons, Sam.
A variety of reasons. The House didn't want to send anybody, and then Harry Reid is, you know, he likes to eat tuna fish or something.
A variety of reasons,
of course. No, he said, that didn't happen for all sorts of... Well, you know, actually, this is fascinating. No, this is actually fascinating. There's a typo here that he had. Obviously didn't check this. And he says, the House and Senate passed their budget plans in late March. The president's proposed. Now, you'll recall, up until March, for years, we had been hearing from the Republicans, the Senate refuses to pass a budget. The Senate refuses to pass a budget. The Senate refuses to pass a budget. Why won't they pass a budget? So they pass a budget. The House has passed their budget. And I read, this happened back in the spring. The House and the Senate passed their budget plans in late March. The president's proposal, the last to be issued, came out on April 10. After that, the House and the Senate are supposed to hash out differences, parens, always with the plenty of presidential input and nudging, and then come up with a document for the president to sign. This is the tell, folks. That didn't happen for all sorts of reason. There is no S on the end of that word reason in this piece I am reading.
It's the most Jungian piece of political writing
ever. It was as if I am trying so hard to hide the truth here, but something inside me is coming up through my fingers into my typewriter. And then he goes on to say, frustrated by the pathetic showing of Mitt Romney in the 2012 elections and the Supreme Court ruling upholding Obamacare, House Republicans were in no mood to do their most basic function. A boo-hoo. Now, here's the other reason. that he is mentioning. The Senate hadn't passed a budget in 4 years. Well, that's not relevant. So maybe they were so impressed with themselves that they had no interest in finishing the job, which meant seeing it through to completion. They sent conferees to the conference. When they got there, there was no one else there. And then he doesn't seem to offer another reason. Oh, that, but he says it's because John Boehner and Harry Reid are sad sacks. Well, there you go. I mean, this is what poses as the real intellectual guys with the integrity on the right. I mean, honestly, that's what poses. Those are the people who are supposedly the thinking man's Republicans.
All right, look, let's cut past all the verbiage here. Here's the real deal. Harry Reid's a sad sack.
Yeah.
Okay, that's some deep analysis.
He's a sad sack. Look at him.
We talk ideologically, but Harry Reid's a sad
he's
sack.
A sad
get
sack.
Real here.
I'm just doing an intellectual breakdown here. That's all sorts of reason. Folks, the podcast awards are open today. We have won the best news political podcast for 2 years in a row. And we have won because of you, ladies and gentlemen. So please head to podcastawards.com, nominate us for best news and politics and people's choice. And voting will, I guess, start sometime in when? In November? And when does voting start?
The nominations end October 15th.
All right, so you got 2 weeks to nominate us. We got to get a bunch of nominations to get there.
That doesn't mean wait till the end. Yes, that means
go now.
Vote early.
You can do it once
often.
A day.
You can do it once a day. Understand, people are gunning for us this time.
Vote early, vote often.
That's right. This is one of those few occasions where you can actually say that and not feel despicable. Folks, also, reminder, our app is available. I didn't send a push notification about the show today, but I generally do just so you get a reminder and an update as to who's on it. You can also support this program by doing a one-off donation via the app on the support page or on the homepage of majority.fm. You can become a member, which is the biggest prize for us, for literally pennies a day. You can support this program bringing you great content 5 days a week. Some days better than others, but some days are transcendent. Yesterday, people were ecstatic. Pennies a day. And then you also get the rest of the membership benefits, including another 40 minutes, 50 minutes of the show. You can also support this program by buying your crap. If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link. You will notice no difference. But we will get a kickback, and every little bit helps, believe me. Trying to pay off that app as we speak. I owe Kyle a check. Bah, bah, bah. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. We'll come back. The better half of the show, the number 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. Podcastawards.com. You can IM me. We'll see you in a sec.